Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. If you were a scientist and you had $100 million to play with, what would you research? Dr. Peter Hackett figures it's time we put that kind of money towards big-time R&D in this province, and his pick is nanotechnology with the new Ingenuity Accelerator Program. And water scientist Dr. David Schindler cautions against salvage logging trees killed by mountain pine beetle to avoid floods and other hydrological disasters. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. With an endowment fund of $1 billion to manage for Alberta Ingenuity, Dr. Peter Hackett figures it's time to take a gamble on our future and make a big bet on bringing big science to Alberta. Peter is the president and CEO of Alberta Ingenuity. This week, he unveiled the Ingenuity Accelerator Program, and the first of five science accelerators will be in nanotechnology.
Well, the accelerator is the it's going to be the flagship program for Ingenuity, and it's the program where we will get really elite researchers to the province to drive the province's future, essentially. That's what we're hoping. Really what we want to get are the very best star performers who can really make the key discoveries here and then put around them everything that you need in order to capture the benefits so that the benefits stay here and you can get social and economic outcomes. But the real key, and it's almost un-Canadian, is to really make a big bet and try to be first at something.
How much money are you putting into this?
Well, we're going to put $100 million over 10 years. And what we'd like to see is that that goes into as few as three researchers who will be called the directors of these laboratories. And they'll use that money to put around them the people and the equipment that they need to get things done.
Now, the first one you're dealing with is nanotechnology. Why nanotechnology?
Well, nanotechnology is the province's key strategy right at the minute. Alberta last May actually, announced a nanotechnology strategy, building on the National Institute of Nanotechnology and many of the companies that we have in Edmonton and in Calgary that are starting out in nanotechnology. And this is an area where you can expect big benefits that will come out of science and engineering and spill out into environment and energy, health and medical, and agriculture and forestry. In each of these areas, you could see where there could be a big impact of nanotechnology. And the accelerator program lines up behind that. It's just a piece of that big strategy. But as I've said, I think it's the flagship and key piece.
Now, you've made this announcement in Calgary. Does that mean that the nanotechnology accelerator program will be centered in Calgary?
No, not necessarily. We're talking to all of the research institutions in Alberta, and we're hoping to get from them exciting proposals, and we're going to choose the best of those. Not necessarily in Calgary, just that the announcement's being made in Calgary.
So in a sense, this is really just the first step towards this new accelerator center.
Yeah, we hope that this is going to be a very public process that will get a lot of interest for Alberta around the world. It's Alberta really stepping up to the global level. It's hard to think of another research exercise that's being done at this level, but what comes to mind is California and the Scripps Institutes and places like the Max Planck and Fraunhofer Institutes in Germany. So this is a really significant piece of business that Alberta's stepping out to do. We want to do it publicly and have each stage of the process observed around the world so that Alberta gets to be known as a, at the end of the day, as a global innovation icon, and so that it attracts to Alberta the kind of people that we're going to need. It's hard to underplay the importance of branding, the importance of being recognized as a place in the world where the very best people want to come to, because there's an enormous competition for this all around the world. And those are the people who create the future, and we want them to create the future here.
But why would they want to come to Alberta? They have the rest of the world to go to.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I can tell you why I want to be in Alberta. Maybe that's... So I see a big change going on here. I'm not sure that we all appreciate where we've got to, but we've got to a pretty sweet spot. Alberta's rich. It has no debt, no deficit, $40 billion of saving in the Heritage Fund, and I think it's going to get a lot richer. We've got $100 billion of investments announced for the oil sands, and that has its own challenges, but it really indicates that we're going to stay rich for a long time. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I see really going on here is that a lot of smart people are coming here. Alberta's got more engineers per capita than any province in Canada. It's more engineers in Calgary than there are in the auto patch in Ontario. Fort McMurray has the highest proportion of engineers of any city in Canada. So there's an enormous influx of bright people coming to the province to drive this economic development, and those people have their own expectations, which are very sophisticated. And if you couple that with the risk-taking and entrepreneurship that got the province to where it got to in less than 100 years, you've got a pretty powerful mix. So you've got riches, entrepreneurship, and bright, well-educated people. So this is going to be the place to be for a real long time. I think we're going to stay rich for a real long time. You've got all kinds of examples of that. Smart technologies in Calgary, Castle Rock in Edmonton. These are two companies that are really creating knowledge-based products based on, again, smart people. Good business sense. In Calgary, you've got emerging a very sophisticated corporate sector with the finance and legal expertise that you're going to need to drive forward. So I think this is the place to be for me. And the only question for me is where Alberta's going to invest all this riches in order to keep the engine going. So if I were starting out in science and had an appreciation of what is possible here, I'd want to come here. And in a way, the accelerators are just a beacon for that. We're saying, look, if you're the best in the world, then you should think about Alberta as the place to be.
What support would there be for those researchers who come here? The money, obviously, is there, but is it going to flow through? Are they going to have the other resources or the environment they need in order to be truly creative in their scientific endeavor?
Yeah, I'm real optimistic about that. All of the things that I told you about the changes going on in Alberta are really the necessary ingredients to make the system here quite sustainable. I don't think we've got too many more pieces of the puzzle to put in place. I think we're on the verge of creating in Alberta what you see in around Boston, what you see in around Silicon Valley, and what you see in and around Cambridge in England. Smart people, entrepreneurship, and a great deal of wealth. And it isn't going to take too much more to put all of that together so it becomes a real driving economic engine.
Does the population support that when you think that we're still struggling to get people to appreciate science or to be scientifically illiterate? Do we really appreciate that?
I've said there's a big change in the population that's coming in. So I think that, and I'll tell you something else that gives me a lot. You know, Alberta has this high achievement in science and maths in its high schools. That says that the population's getting there. We may not be there yet, but we are going to get there. We can't stop that work. We do have to engage the public every step of the way in the kind of things we're interested in investing in, because they do need to support government making those investments, and they do need to support the kind of products that come out of knowledge-intensive firms. So if you don't have the public with you, it isn't going to work. That's part of what it is to be a dynamic global innovation system. So we've got to keep the public engaged, and that's a key part of what we want the accelerator folks to do, is to explain and engage the public at all times. But this is not impossible. I look at the Perimeter Institute, which does theoretical physics, the most basic science that you could imagine. Mike Lazaridis, who's the head of Research in Motion, he's put $100 million into that. And about every month, it has 500 people from around Toronto and Waterloo come to listen to lectures on theoretical physics, which is really quite quite outstanding, quite exceptional, something that you wouldn't have thought. So I think the public has a huge appetite for this. We have a responsibility to keep them engaged, but I'm real optimistic that it can be done.
Well, just getting back to nanotechnology, what do you see coming out of the nanotechnology research? What are some of the things that we can wrap our imagination around?
To begin with, let's go up to the oil sands. So you think immediately of improved catalysts, bringing down the amount of energy that goes into extracting that resource. You think of improved separation techniques, so you can have cleaner water coming off the oil sands plants. We have recruited, and I think you've done a little show on Steve Kuznicki, who has found a way to produce nanostructured silver that can be used as an antiviral and for wound healing. And he's really, really creative, and he's brought the price of that down by over a factor of 100. So you can see medical benefits coming right out of that right away. Coatings on the machinery that's used in the oil sands to reduce wear. A factor that I've just heard is really quite astounding, that each of these oil sands plants has a $2 billion a year materials bill because of all the materials that they wear out. So there's a great opportunity there for new materials to come into the process and reduce the cost. And we can see companies coming to Alberta just to be part of that. Some of the global firms are here just for that reason, or coming here. So those are a few of the things.
Nanotechnology, what comes after that?
Okay, that's a real interesting question. I can just give you, my thoughts today. It's something that we'd obviously have to keep working with our partners across the province, but we would like to have five of these areas identified. I think the next one is pretty easy. That would be energy. Beyond that, the environment, clearly important, water and the environment. Agriculture, value-added agriculture, life sciences, and further on out, I guess the health industries probably. But five big areas like that are the kind of areas that we'd like to play in.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Peter Hackett, President and CEO of Alberta Ingenuity.
Thank you.
In just a few short years, outbreaks of mountain pine beetle have moved across British Columbia and are now entrenched in Alberta's lodgepole pine forests along the eastern slopes. The beetles have usually been kept in check by cold winters with temperatures hitting minus 30. But global warming is changing that, and what the future holds could be quite grim indeed. The Sustainable Forest Management Network recently co-hosted a workshop on the relationship between mountain pine beetle outbreaks and hydrology. Scientists and foresters from Western Canada and the United States gathered to share their experiences and their cautions. Among the presenters was world-renowned water scientist Dr. David Schindler. He's a Killam Memorial Chair and Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. Taking the big picture into account, David ties together forest ecology, logging practices, climate change, and what this means for watersheds affected by mountain pine beetles.
It's a type of insult to forests that I think is very predictable. What kills trees stops trees from transpiring. So a lot of the water that leaves our watersheds is via transpiring trees. And if they're dead and not transpiring, that water's left on the ground to run off into aquifers and rivers and so forth. So pine beetle has, in that respect, effects that are similar to logging or forest fire or other types of insults that destroy or remove trees from the landscape. The effects of pine beetle don't seem to be quite as devastating as clear-cut logging or fire, probably because for the first several years there are some needles left on the trees, and they slowly fall off, but even so there are dead trees left standing on the landscape that keep the soils more intact than if they were disturbed, and also provide some shade for new seedlings to come in. So reforestation is quite quick after a mountain pine beetle outbreak, at least at lower elevations. One other problem, though, is you're very likely with pine beetle to have a second insult follow within a few years, and that's forest fire. And the combination of insults like that in rapid succession is a particular disaster for watersheds. From an aquatic standpoint, what we worry about is that if you have a pine beetle kill, and that's followed by a fire, or worse yet, by salvage logging, which not only removes the trees but digs up the soils and creates roads that erode and landings and things like that, you expect the effects to amplify. So that's what we can expect.
In the last few years, there's more of an emphasis put on salvage logging. And why is it that it's worse?
What it does first is to make big gouges in the soil, because we do it with heavy equipment. we could probably do a better job if we'd go back to using horses, or there are other expensive ways like using helicopters and cables and things like that. But most of what we're doing is with traditional skidders and feller bunchers, big equipment that needs good roads to get it into position. And I think those roads are about half the damage, and the landings for loading trucks and things. But any soil disturbance, doesn't have to be logging, will cause that kind of problem. A very hot fire, for example, will have the same effect. So it's a matter of degree on any one of these insults as to how much effect it's going to have.
Is it better just to leave those dead trees standing?
I think that at least on high slopes, we ought to leave the dead trees there. Number one, many of those slopes, like that C5 area where logging is controversial right now, are susceptible to mudslides at the best of times, even when they're fully forested. So if you kill them with pine beetle, you increase that susceptibility somewhat. And then if you put in logging equipment on those same slopes, you disturb them even more. And I think the big fear is that turbidity will go up in those tributaries and be transmitted down into the lower reaches of the Old Man and the Bow in particular, where cities like Calgary and Lethbridge have to filter that back out before they can treat the water for drinking. And of course, that can be hundreds of millions of dollars in expense if you have to upgrade filtration parts of water treatment plants.
With the extent of the pine beetle infestation that we have now, we also have global warming, and that's going to increase fires, and it looks like it's not going to put a damper on the pine beetle infestation because it's not getting cooler or colder to kill them in the wintertime. So one of the concerns is that there is going to be more dead trees and a higher fuel load, and so then more fires there, and it's going to affect more people. How do we deal with it in that sense, as things are getting worse rather than just better?
One way we can deal with it is most of the big population increases so far have been on flatlands, and we ought to keep them there. Most of the areas around our major cities and that have already been logged, so there's not an immediate pine beetle effect there. So if we concentrate on the headwaters, select the really sensitive areas and leave them alone would be my recommendation. Do as much as we can on the next most sensitive slopes with horses or something like that if we have to log. Right now, logging makes no sense at all. It's a no-brainer. They're awash in red ink. We have logging sawmills and pulp and paper plants closing across Canada, including here in Alberta. Why are we paying them to cut our trees? I think, though, that on the whole, we see a disaster in the making here. And if you trace the origins, it's all climate warming. It's one of those nasty surprises that scientists have been predicting for years, and skeptics have been saying, ha ha. 20 years ago, nobody talked about pine beetle increasing. They did talk about forest fires increasing simply because of warmer weather. Warmer weather equals more fires in any statistical analysis of forestry data that's been done. So here we have a double whammy, more fuel and higher temperatures. But there's a third one that you hardly hear mentioned. And that is, this is what we call a positive feedback on greenhouse gas emissions. If you look at how much CO2 is emitted from forest fires in Canada in the past, the really high fire years have released almost as much CO2 to the atmosphere as industry in Canada. So if we're going to double or triple that amount of CO2 release caused by forest fire, we could get into this cycle that scientists have hypothesized that, I guess, to make it simple, the warming will increase the warming. Warming causes pine beetle, causes more fire weather, causes more forest fire, causes more CO2. So we get this feedback that feeds itself, and we could get into climate warming beyond anything that we have estimated to date, because our climate models don't account for this sort of thing.
Well, it sounds then that given the situation we're in, pine beetles not going away, perhaps what this is nature's way of clearing out the forest and changing that whole landscape.
I think that's true. And of course, we've seen, and we should have known from spruce budworm and other things, that the last thing you want is big monoculture stretches of one species. The lodgepole pine, of course, were naturally that way, but what I think is a no-brainer is to see forestry companies cutting them and then going back in and planting more lodgepole pine. However, as the fellow from Colorado who's going to speak later this morning mentioned, when pine beetle have run out of pine in Colorado, they've attacked spruce. So we may have not seen the end of the damage yet.
Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome, Cheryl.
That was Dr. David Schindler, water scientist and Killam Memorial Chair and Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. He was speaking at a workshop on hydrology and mountain pine beetles, which was co-hosted by the Sustainable Forest Management Network and Alberta Sustainable Resource Development. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Genome Alberta, the Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.